Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
And listener, today is we. Special podcast for us, for ERD, as we are joined by the Jared Kimber, one of the most insightful cricketing mind right now, who has been talking and working on cricket. You may check his YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, and he has written books on the topic cricket as well. So we welcome you, Jared, on our show, and I hope that you are as excited as we are to host you today.
Oh, I'm here. I'm ready to go.
Okay, thank you, Kimber. Okay, Kimber, let's just begin then. We have seen recently concluded Asia Cup. How would you rate that hybrid model? I mean, we have seen lots of traveling, then rain interruptions, then washout games. And there was a reserve day for the, especially for the Pakistan and India game. So how would you rate that hybrid model and this recently concluded edition of the Asia Cup?
I mean, the Asia Cup is an interesting tournament in that I think there's a whole generation of people who've grown up thinking it's a very big deal. And I think we saw in this tournament that it's probably not. I mean, the fact that it changes between ODIs and T20s kind of tells you. I would love to see a rugby tournament where one year is rugby league, another year is rugby union. You know, it's a very bizarre kind of structure to begin with. But in this case, it's an ideal warm-up, and I, you know, would hope that that's how the teams looked at it, really. I'd be disappointed if any team was desperate to have won the Asia Cup when realistically the best thing to learn is, you know, a little bit about your opposition, you know, groove your team a little bit more, maybe experiment a little bit with some certain players and then go from there. But yeah, the rain was obviously an issue. The location was an issue. Having reserve days for certain teams and not other teams, it just devalues the tournament, right? I already think it's a bit silly that it goes between T20 and one-day cricket. And now that it's like, but one lot of games is going to have rain reserves and the other ones aren't, right? I've got no problem with everyone having rain reserves and they can still maintain the illusion. And that's the thing with sport. We'll take a lot of nonsense, right? But there is a certain point where what we actually need to see is the actual... Yes. That it matters. And I think what they did with that, with those rain regulations was basically say, it doesn't really matter if it gets rained out for Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. You're not important. We've only really set this up so we can get India and Pakistan games together because we're not allowed to play each other bilaterally.
Okay. Jared, you summed it nicely that bizarre tournament. You may just say it. Okay. However, if I ask you to pick up any three players from the Asia Cup, because we have seen so many good performances from the Sri Lanka as well. I mean, they are missing out their main players, that India and even Bangladesh performing well. So how top three players from the Asia Cup?
Oh, I don't know if I have a top three. I mean, I love what Shanto did early, and then obviously he exploded his hamstring. So I'm not sure he would get in there. I think what we've seen from Tikshana is just how elite his bowling is. I think it's weird because he doesn't spin the ball a long way. I think he gets a little bit underrated at times, and we've seen how well he's bowled in the IPL, but he could be a really important player in this World Cup because I don't think there are many spinners who can bowl in all three different areas. And then I suppose the other ones would be that, you know, there's been this, I want to say, there's been this feeling in Indian cricket that they haven't had number four batters for a while in ODI cricket. And to be honest, we've done the research. It doesn't really bear out, but they kind of believe that that is the case. So having Ishan Kishan and KL Rahul as potentials for number four, obviously Shreyas Iyer might come back as well, certainly makes that position a lot stronger than it has been before. So those are probably, I probably more look at, I probably wouldn't be looking at like the best players in the tournament. I'm probably more looking towards the World Cup and how things go ahead. So those are three really interesting players for the World Cup. If Bangladesh don't have an opening batter who can whack it, or a top order player who can whack it, I should say, then just not going to score. They're not going to put pressure on the opposition teams enough. You know, Sri Lanka have to be a threat all the way through the innings because their batting up as we just saw, not very good. And in India's case, I think that in order to free their top three up and let them play the way that they should be playing, they need to know that number four and number five is completely solid. And I don't think they've always felt that way coming into major tournaments. Even if I said it's not always, it doesn't always hold true, but they've believed that to be true. So coming into a major tournament where they might feel like there's more strength behind them will allow those top three to attack even harder. So those are three of the most interesting sort of subplots that I saw from individual players.
Okay, well, you spoke about Sri Lanka and its prospects for the World Cup. I mean, Sri Lanka went into Asia Cup without Hasaranga. He's one of the main players, but still managed to enter the final. So, whatever happened in the final, they should enter the World Cup with a bit of confidence, don't you think, the way they performed?
Yes, I suppose. I mean, they just got bowled out for 50, so even if they made the final, I'm not sure how much confidence I'll take. Look, I think I have them ranked as the eighth on. I think I have them ranked as the eighth best batting side. Right? If they have confidence going into that World Cup, you know, it may be misplaced. I'd be shocked if they can make enough runs to consistently bother the teams who do make a lot of runs. So, you know, South Africa and New Zealand, Pakistan. Those are the sorts of the middle tier teams. And then, you know, your upper teams. You know, India, Australia, and England. I don't see how Sri Lanka can consistently make enough runs against some of those teams that have decent bowlers themselves, and in some cases, brilliant bowlers, as India just showed. And so, yeah, you know, it's not the worst thing that's ever happened to Sri Lankan cricket. They made it through to the Asia Cup final. But if I was working with them, if I was Chris Silverwood and I was their coach, I'd be saying, we made it to the final, and so there are good signs here. But let's not pretend that we didn't get smashed in the face in the final and that we're still not making enough runs. I think they have a fantastic bowling attack, and I think that makes them a danger against any team in this World Cup. But they're going to have to score 250 runs to be able to be consistently using that bowling attack. If not, they're asking their bowling attack to basically perform miracles. I mean, you have to win six games, right, to make the semifinals. That's a lot of miracles.
That's a lot of miracles, for sure. But you take whatever confidence you have in this jump ahead to the tournament. And let's just transition to the World Cup now. I mean, we saw Pakistan had a lot of ups and downs in the tournament so far. So what are three things that they have to fix before jumping into the World Cup, Pakistan team?
I don't think there's anything they can fix. I mean, I can tell you things that they have issues with, but I don't think there's anything that they could fix. Like, this is the team they are. This is how they're going to go ahead with the World Cup. I think their biggest issue is that they don't have the ability to take wickets between overs 10 and 40 with spinners. It's not that their spinners aren't good. Shadab Khan would be a fantastic secondary spinner, but he needs to be matched with a strike spinner, right? So if you think of Shadab Khan like a better version of Moeen Ali, he needs an Adil Rashid beside him, right? And they're not going to have that. You know, they basically have what I would say is two holding spinners, which are absolutely fine. But I think if you look at the way that Pakistan bat, they need to be able to take wickets regularly throughout that innings. And so they were incredibly reliant on their seamers to take a lot of wickets at the top or even come back and take a lot of wickets in the middle. And I don't see this as a attack where the seamers can come back and take a lot of wickets in the middle. But, you know, as we know with Pakistan, you know, one seamer gets on fire and suddenly becomes something quite different in the middle of the tournament. That's still a possibility. But I think it was quite telling. It might have even been Shadab who said this, but I can't remember who the Pakistani player was. But when they won one of their earlier games and their bowlers were doing great, he basically said, if they keep doing this, it'll be great. And that's the problem, right? Because it goes back to what we just said about Sri Lanka. You can rely on your bowlers so much, but eventually you are going to come up against, you know, really good. Yeah. Bowling out the South African batting lineup is almost impossible. They are so strong from one through to six. And they've been doing it. They've probably been the best batting lineup in the world from one through to six, you know, since that last World Cup. New Zealand have Kane Williamson. right? All these teams have talent there. To be able to go through those teams regularly is not going to happen, right? We're back in the miracle stage. So how do you manufacture wickets in the middle? I don't know if they can. How do you maintain that your bowlers dominate the way they can? Because you know that your batters are going to bat at a certain pace, right? They're not going to explode. They are going to keep their wickets in hand. They're going to bat within themselves a little bit. So those are the three biggest issues of essentially they either have to work out how to take wickets in the middle or they have to find a way to be above par with their batting scores. And that hasn't been how Pakistan has gone about things. So look, you know, there are weaknesses there, but any tournament where you have Shaheen Afridi, you know, you have a huge advantage over most teams. He probably is the best new ball bowler in the world, although Mohammad Sarraj has been doing pretty good last couple of years as well. But he's absolutely fantastic. You know, you match him with some other people. There's some all-round talent there as well, which is quite handy. You know, having a player of Shadab quality, even if he's not a wicket taker, is a huge plus. You know, to be able to have, you know, Australia would kill to have Shadab Khan, exactly. Right? If Australia had Shadab Khan, they'd probably be the outright World Cup favorites at this point, right? And you know, the same with South Africa. South Africa would kill to have Shadab Khan, but the problem is that Shadab Khan is not being maximized because there isn't another spinner that can do the other sort of job that you need, and so that's the problem with Pakistan. It, you know, they're not a terrible team. I still think they're an above average team. They're, you know, probably somewhere around the second tier if their bowlers really work, maybe even a first tier team in this tournament, and that certainly gives them a chance of winning the tournament. But yeah, there are issues.
Okay, Jared, if I ask you that we talked about Shadab Khan, that if he wants to become a wheelie, there should have been other rushes for him. So who do you think can be second spinner Pakistan can opt out for after the World Cup, because people are talking about Adab Rahim, and I don't think so it's the right time to include him. So who do you think that Pakistan should go for after the World Cup, that they should be, that there should be have spin department option as well for us if our top spinner just don't perform up to the mark?
I mean, looking at the PSL, I would say that the problem with the Pakistani spinners is in general at the moment, and you saw this on the flat pitches in the test matches, right? So it's all the same.
Yes.
Is that you have a lot of very good, consistent holding bowlers that bowl very good lines and lengths that can sometimes be very hard to get away. I don't see, and I can only really go by the PSL and, you know, the little bit that we've seen at the international level. I don't see any Pakistan attacking spinner who is of international quality at the moment. Right. That doesn't mean that someone won't develop or that someone won't come through that I'm unaware of or anywhere else. And that happens, right? I think that fan bases are like, you know, the best one is, you know, Australia and Adam Zampa. Adam Zampa in England, they are so excited to have Adil Rashid, right? Just absolutely thrilled to have Adil Rashid. Adil Rashid is treated like a god. If you look at Adil Rashid's record, it's nowhere near as good as Adam Zampa's. And yet in Australia, everyone's like, oh, we've got Zamps. But, you know, maybe we'll get a proper spinner one day, right? And so fan bases don't always look at these things in the way that they should. Essentially, why are England so excited to have Adil Rashid and why Australia not so excited to have Adam Zampa? Well, it's because before Adam Zampa, there was Brad Hogg and there was Shane Warne. There was also Stuart McGill in the test side. So Australia had higher quality wrist spinners than Adam Zampa at that point, right? Whereas England had no one, right? Before Adil Rashid, they had Ian Salisbury. And if either of you even know who he is, you're doing very, very well, right? They had literally no wrist spinners that they could rely on at all. And so a lot of this is about perception. You go back, there's a whole generation of Pakistani fans who either grew up with Syed Ajmal, Shahid Afridi. Yes. If you go back, Saqlain Mushtaq and Mushtaq Ahmed, right? These are all top-level wicket takers. And also just fantastic bowlers, you know, in some cases across formats, but certainly in limited overs cricket. If that player was around now, they'd be in the team. It's not an accident that they're not there, right? You know, it's a bit like South Africa. Like South Africa fans are very frustrated at times that they don't have an all-rounder. Well, that's because you had Kallis and Klusner and Pollock and McMillan, right? You had a whole generation of the greatest all-rounders ever. And now you have Drain Pretorius and, you know, and Dili Pesslakweyo. Yeah. It's not the same, but sometimes you have to make do with what you have. So, look, I think, yeah, and that's fine. The fans aren't wrong because they have lived through those previous eras. But you can't tell me that there is an international quality spinner, and I mean a wicket-taking spinner, specifically a strike spinner, because I think that's what they're missing, that's out of this World Cup side that is proven. Because if there was that player that was out there, they would be in the side, right? And so what you might get, let's say Pakistan bomb out of this World Cup, right? And it doesn't quite work for them and they don't go anywhere. It'll be a rebuild anyway, won't it? Because you'll be rebuilding towards, you know, a future World Cup. The first thing that Pakistan will be doing is looking to at something slightly different, which will be the one day is, sorry, not the one, the T20 World Cup. Shadab Khan's probably a better T20 player than he is a test player. They might be able to, you know, bring in some other bowlers at that stage and mix and match. But, you know, the truth is that the players that we are talking about, let's say there was a random spinner that I'm not aware of that could come in. Chances are they would be the 15th player in the squad, and they're not going to have a big impact on this tournament anyway. So a lot of people will focus on those sorts of things, like the Harry Brooks situation. So a lot of England fans really happy now Harry Brooks in their team, in their squad. It's like, well, he still probably won't play, right? Unless there's an injury. He's probably not even going to come in. If England are going to win this World Cup, chances are Harry Brook won't be a major part of this unless they completely change their plans, right? And yet, if you talk to fans, you can go back to, you know, all these different teams around the world, it's exactly the same. Everyone thinks the 15th most important player is going to make a big difference. Whereas in truth, even the 9th most important player doesn't usually make a huge difference in a World Cup. It's really, you're carried by your best 6 or 7 players, maybe 8 players if you have a very broad team anyway. And Pakistan don't have in their best 8 players an international quality tested strike bowling spinner. And if they did, they would be there.
Okay. Jared, you talk about like how Harry Brooks was added at the, like Justin Roy got injured. Do you think that Marnus Labuschagne can replace Travis Head because he is injured as well? And Marnus has performed really well even at batting at 8. Batting at it when he was substituted, and he loves to perform as a substitute player as well. So do you think that Marnus can replace Travis Head in the World Cup squad? And he is also the part of the series squad against India. So do you think there's a chance that Marnus is making it to the World Cup squad?
I think if Head doesn't play, Marnus will come in. I don't think he really replaces him. I don't think they want Marnus to open the batting, for instance. So they might go with a slightly different lineup in that World Cup. And that doesn't mean that Marnus might not still be in the side. I think what there's been a bit of a trend of recent times, and it's probably why Harry Brook wasn't in the original squad for England.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of someone else. It's why England was so fascinated with Joe Denley. And we've seen this with South Africa at times as well, of kind of having a backup player in the squad who can bat in any position from 1 to 7, right? And I think that from that perspective, Marnus makes a lot of sense. If that's what they are looking for. If they think that the rest of their batters are absolutely fine and they're willing to risk an injury on the morning of the game or anything like that, then you might pick someone who's a top order player or a middle order player or even a lower order player as your backup batter. But I think that in a World Cup situation where, you know, I mean, one of the most famous moments of this, of course, is when Australia were playing a T20 game years ago and Brad Hodge was putting on his trousers, and when he put on his trousers, he injured his back. One of the more bizarre cricket injuries. There's some really good cricket injuries, like Trevor Sinclair getting run over by a baggage truck at Gatwick Airport. So there's some good ones. There's also the Pakistani opener from the, 1960s, who injured himself when running away from an affair. So there's some really good injuries, but I do think Brad Hodge putting on a pair of trousers is one of the best ones, right? It was a smaller squad. It wasn't like a World Cup. But Stray didn't have a backup available to them in that situation. Luckily, there was a Luke Pommersbatch was in the ground and they could, you know, or in the city and they could bring him down. But if you think about those sorts of things, Marnus Labuschagne makes more sense as a backup because he can open. You may not want him to open, but he can open. And he can also bat at number 6. He can bat at number 8, apparently. So he has the full range of batting.
He can bat everywhere.
He can bat everywhere, exactly. So I do think from that perspective, you know, you are... There's certainly something to be said for that kind of a player, whether, you know, the Australia end up, that's where they go, or whether they actually just want to bring in someone else. They might think he's a better opener. You know, Matthew Short will probably get a go against India, perhaps even opening the batting. They might try out both of them. I'm not sure. Steve Smith could probably open the batting, you know, if need be as well. So they have, you know, and, you know, I think eventually Cameron Green will open the batting or maybe bat number 3 in white ball cricket. So they have options.
All right. Okay, Marnus, before we... Jared. Okay. Yes.
I think he's shorter than me.
That's
more of a South
number
African
one.
Accent. He doesn't really have a South African
accent. Okay, Jared, before we continue with the show, let's have some rapid fire. You have to name a cricketer after listening to the question comes to mind. Like, be honest. Just name the cricketer that comes to your mind.
Benny Hill.
So,
yes. We haven't started. Go.
Yes. Question number one is, who has got the best Yorker in the cricketing world right now?
Oh, that's a really good question. Mitchell Stark.
Who plays the best pull shot?
Rohit Sharma.
Who should be named as the chalkers in the cricketing world? Which team should be named as the chalkers in the cricketing world? That's controversial.
I suppose India played question. In the most recent finals. But yeah, I mean, I don't really like choker because I think there's usually a reason you lose that isn't choking. But if you're asking which team has lost the most finals, I suppose it's them, isn't it?
Okay, India. Who is the most exciting prospect right now in the cricketing world, in your opinion?
I suppose a year ago you would say it was Cameron Green, but I'm not sure he's as exciting now. Jaiswal is really exciting. Obviously, Dibble Brevis, Marco Jansen. It's maybe Marco Jansen still. Trying to think if there's anyone else I'm missing. I mean, Marco Jansen, we've never had a combination. If Marco Jansen can bat, it's certainly Marco Jansen. And at the moment, we think maybe he can bat, so I'll go with him.
Okay, last but not the least, who has the most deceiving ugly?
It's probably still Imran Tahir, right? Or Rashid Khan, but it might still be Imran Tahir, with the last dying days of him. But yeah, it'd probably be Rashid Khan or Imran Tahir.
Okay, so Rashid Khan or Imran Tahir. Okay, thanks, Kimber, for this. And let's continue with the further questions. I wanted to ask you about women's cricket in Pakistan. You know that there is not as much hype created and the women's cricket if we talk about the women's cricket in Pakistan. So what do you think that five steps that PCB should take to enhance the quality and promoting women's cricket in Pakistan? Because it is a time that Pakistan should promote and invest in the women's cricket. So can you enlist any of the five steps that PCB should take in order to enhance and promote women's cricket in Pakistan?
Well, is there a women's PSL?
I don't think so. I mean, they were supposed to, but no news, no further.
I mean, that would be steps 1 through 4 at the moment. That's kind of where you have to start. Ramiz Raja, I don't know how many people know this. Ramiz Raja was desperate to have a women's PSL before the women's IPL. I don't know why that hasn't been talked about as well. I mean, for all the mistakes he made and, he's obviously had problems with his management style and taking over the game and all these different things. He got it. He got that part of it and was ahead of the game. And the fact that they don't have a women's PSL, I don't think you can be consistently good in women's cricket now without a strong local league where women are paid to play, right? Because what you are relying on is the fact that you might get a bunch of good amateurs come together in one crop. So South Africa in 2008, 2010, Sri Lanka in a similar period, Bangladesh at the moment, right? But essentially, if you want to be consistently good at sport, you need to pay your players, right? They need to be doing it full time. I remember when I talked to, one of the women's Big Bash coaches, the batting coach, I think it was, and I said, why are women hitting more sixes? And he said, well, beforehand, women would work 40 hours a week. So she works 8 hours a day. In the morning, she would do probably a little bit of cardio work, maybe some strength work if she gets a chance. She then finishes work at, let's say, 4 or 5 p.m. She comes down, she does 2 hours of training. So she's doing net stuff. She's doing fielding stuff, whatever. Then at the end of that, if she has any energy left, she will hit the weights room a little bit. And he said, the difference now is they can hit the weights room for like 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day and still be rested for when they have cricket training, right? That's the difference. That's professionalism. We don't talk about this enough in cricket, but if you look at the West Indies men's team when they got great from 1975 through to 1995, it was largely on the back of county cricket and Kerry Packer and a professionalism of those players going away from the West Indies, playing like professionals, thinking like professionals, playing cricket 12 months of the year, looking after their bodies, looking after their core strength. I don't think core strength had ever been mentioned in cricket before Malcolm Marshall did 500 sit-ups a day, right? And they became the best team in the world. The team that takes over from their reign is the Australian team, who is the first team where everyone is on a 12-month contract, where they have access to academies, where Matthew Hayden can just get on the phone and call up a selector and go, do you know what? I know I'm not a star at the moment, but I think I'm going to be a really good player. Can I go to India and work on my play against India? This is what professional cricketers do. This is how they get better. The league is the best way of doing that, because if you just give Pakistan women money to play for the national team, which is nice, and obviously there is some money there and there's match fees and all those sorts of things, you're only giving it to 11, 12, 14, 18, 22 people, right? If you have a league, you know, even if you have four teams, you're instantly, you know, looking at around 50 to 55 players. Right. It's way more important to get more players available than it is anything else. So, yes, so league would be first. Paying the cricketers to be professionals 12 months round would be second. But there are cultural issues, right? You know, this, you know, sure. Australia got an international cricketer in part because he was helping young Pakistani women play cricket. And, you know, Farwood was, you know, not it was frowned upon, I suppose is the best way of putting it, but you know, the way that he talks about it was a little bit worse. That isn't happening in other places. So the way that you think about women in Pakistan has to change, right? That has to be that, you know, that has to be the other thing. The other thing I would say is, and this is something I've seen even in men's Pakistan cricket, is that there is still this, I'm trying to think of the best way of putting it. I don't think, compared to India, right? In India, there are a lot of young people who think that cricket is a potential profession for them, right? And their parents think that. And so they get thrown into all these academies and get all the training they can get. I've got a lot of friends who've worked in Pakistani cricket, you know, Pakistanis and non-Pakistanis as well. And they say it's the one place where they find it the hardest to convince parents that this is a profession.
Exactly.
It is a job, right? True. And if that's happening with the men's cricket, I can only imagine what's going to happen with the women's cricket, right? Yes. But that's a real shift. And look, there are different cultures. I remember working with cricket talking to the people in Hong Kong cricket. So completely different, both in Asia, but completely different, you know, ethnic problems, religious problems and everything else. But that was a big problem in Hong Kong cricket. They could get young cricketers who were really good, but the minute they tried to get them to really upskill their cricket, their parents would be like, no. This isn't a job. Sport is not a job. And that's not just
get a job
in Hong Kong. Yeah, get a real job. In Hong Kong, they don't if you think of Hong Kong, how many great athletes have come out of Hong Kong? It's not a cult. They don't even think about it as a profession. Right? Yes. That has to change in Pakistan as well. So that's probably four major things that I could think of off the top of it. The only other thing I would say is that I believe that traditionally there has been a cultural aspect, and this is right across women's cricket, so it's certainly not a Pakistan thing, but there's been a lot of rich families that have allowed their daughters to play, and obviously that has been a benefit. In some cases, those families have literally put money into the Pakistan women's team to allow them to play. You can't have a sport where parents are funding the sport. You can't have a sport where the half the team is there because they come from a privileged background. And that used to be the case in the men's team as well, of course. You know, the old days of you got into the Pakistan men's team if you studied at a good English university and all that sort of stuff. But you're not going to get any better if only rich people are playing a sport. You're talking about how many people live in Pakistan? 220 million? Have I got that number right? Did I make that up?
Yes.
Yeah, right? You can't have a sport where 4 million people are playing it and the other, you know, 218 million are not, right? It has to be a sport for all. And part of that also comes back to all the professionalism I talked about before. You want to fix cricket in any place on earth, the first thing you need to do is make sure that enough cricketers are being paid and that they have equipment and that they have conditions that they can be able to do that. And they don't have to worry about all the other things. And it's harder for women anyway. Forget the cultural aspect of Pakistan and Islam.
Exactly.
Women's sport, it is so hard for them to do it because they get to a certain, you know, if they get a family, you know, generally in most cultures, Western, Eastern, anywhere, the woman does more stuff around the house than the man. So they've already got a full-time job. Now they've got a family job and now they're trying to become a cricketer. You have to make these things easier. on women. And you also have to understand that women in general don't want, especially married women, but this is pretty much, I think this has been proved right across the board, women don't like to go on as long tours as men when it comes to this. So when you are planning these things, you need to reframe the way you think about sport when you were dealing with, or cricket, I should say, when you were dealing with women's cricket. Because it is very, very different, the way that you have to think about all those different sides of things. And it's not easy. Like, you know, it's more than great that we can have this conversation. There are many places, if I was brought onto a Pakistani TV station where I would just have an angry old bald man with a big pot belly yelling at me about how women aren't very good at cricket right now, right? Like that, right? That exists. But I just had an argument with a Western guy because I've said that women should get, you know, we should be moving towards equal pay in women's cricket. And he's not very happy. He wants the Sri Lankan first-class player who no one goes and watches, and Sri Lanka doesn't make any money off their test cricket, to get paid a healthy wage. But when I suggest that the women should get paid a healthy wage, he's like, whoa, their league doesn't make any money because of all that money that Sri Lankan first-class cricket makes. So there are... I understand all those prejudices exist, you know, throughout women's cricket. I wonder if, and I talk to Raf Nicholson a lot, and she talks about the fact that women's cricket should be run by people who like women's cricket, which is a novel thing, but not exactly how it's run at the moment. I think, again, in Pakistan, the PCB obviously help. But if the PCB, if their main interest is the men's team, and women's always going to be a subsidiary to that. And I think 30 years ago or 20 years ago, you wanted the men's money to help prop up the women's game. That's not really the same as it used to be now. And there is an organizational structure now within women's cricket. So I think Pakistan is one of the teams, not that they would go out on their own, but if women's cricket was to split from men's cricket, I actually think that would help Pakistan as well. And I should say that I actually think in the future that cricket will be completely split up. I think Test cricket will be run on its own. ODI cricket will be run on its own. T20 will be run on its own. Women's cricket might even be split up into all those different things itself, but it will be run on its own. Just because I don't see, as women's cricket gets bigger, how, you know, being the second banana permanently to the ICC is ever going to help anyone.
Okay.
So... that was a really nice conversation about the women's cricket. So let's jump back to the World Cup. Injuries have just taken over the entire World Cup. Like every team has almost like the main players getting injured again and again. It's Tim Southee recently, then Nassim Shah, and Jason Roy got injured again. So like, how are these teams going to manage these players? And how are they why are we facing so many injuries in the world of cricket right now?
We play a lot of top level cricket, but I think if you look back at the history of World Cups, I think generally there are a lot of injuries. You're talking about 150 cricketers, and how many injuries are we talking about? Maybe 15 or 20. That seems like a fairly normal rate to me. It's just that you don't notice that Tim Southee is injured normally, right? You don't notice that Jason Roy is injured normally, because there's no reason for you to, right? Like the amount of times I'm about to cover a series and I'm like, why is this guy not playing? And everyone's like, oh, I remember that knee injury he had 3 months ago, it hasn't healed. I'm like, oh, vaguely remember him going off in one game, right? At the World Cup, everyone's looking at it, right? We're looking at the squads, we're looking at all these different things. So I do think there is a difference from that perspective when you look at those things for a World Cup. So yeah, look, it always plays a part. I don't think there's any, you know, whether it be Shane Warne and Jason Gillespie pulling out of the 2003 World Cup, you know, one, well, not pulling out in Warne's case, but being suspended in Warne's case and Gillespie being injured. You know, Waqar Yunus didn't play in 92 World Cup. And yet those teams still went on to win, right? You know, you have to have that ability. I don't think West Indies in one of their tournaments, I don't think had their best lineup either. So there's certainly been plenty of occasions when teams have gone on to win World Cups without their best players. World Cups are problem-solving events, right? You've got, in this case, 9 different opposition. You've got different pitches in different locations that will play very separately. You don't have a wide squad to be able, you know, to be able to pick a bunch of specialists. You know, there are teams like India is a perfect example of a team that probably has 5 great spinners that they could use, but can't fit 5 spinners in a squad. Pakistan could probably have 7 seamers, right? Australia would probably love to have maybe Aaron Hardy on the bench and, you know, maybe a third spinner just in case anything goes wrong. We don't have that. So they're problem-solving events, and the injuries are part of that, right? How you handle those sorts of things. And we saw with England, they had five injuries to their starting 11. I think it was to their starting 11 for the 2000 and whatever, the UAE T20 World Cup, right? We know now they were probably the best team in that tournament, but they didn't win it, right? Because they had so many injuries. And we have seen that before, and we will see that again. It's just, it is part of what you have to do in this tournament. And I would argue that the small squad sizes don't really help anyone, but they do make that problem-solving element even more crucial.
That to be honest, sounded like, you know, I recently saw your video about two cricket balls, the problem of that. And it is pretty much analogous to people think that, okay, two cricket balls have changed things. But, and I also thought that they did change things, but watching that video really made me realize that the facts and figures are totally like against that. And I think you're right here that we notice things because it's a World Cup. So. Yeah.
Well, the two balls thing that you're talking about is a perfect example of everyone, especially in Asia, saw that as a direct attack on them, right? Despite the fact that we had two new balls before, we went to one ball, and I don't think the other teams ever went, oh, great, now we've got, you know, now we've got a disadvantage, right? So it's really interesting the way the two different places went about that. But the two new balls actually helped spinners more, because the ball bounces more and it brings spin bowling into the game more. And if you look at those numbers, especially in Asia, it certainly does help. Also now, like, you can't win a World Cup without good seam bowling, right? So it doesn't matter if you're an Asian team or a Western team, right? If you don't have really good seam bowling, you're not going to win. And realistically, you know, India and Pakistan are the two teams most likely to win the World Cup from Asia. Let's throw Sri Lanka in as the third choice there. That fantastic seam bowls options to, you know, to all three of those teams, right? And so we do. I think, you know, sometimes what happens is around a World Cup, we get very, very infatuated with particular narratives and everything else. Reverse swing has certainly died under the two new ball era of ODI cricket. But the reason that reverse swing was working before is because the balls were falling apart. Right? And those old balls were not fit for purpose. We should not have been using those in international events, certainly not in World Cups. The real argument should be is how are we 50 years on from the birth of white balls and we still can't get them to 50 overs, right? So we either need to get rid of them and use the pink ball, which I actually think, especially for one-day cricket, would make a lot more sense. Or we just need to go, let's invest some money finally in the white ball and do that. So look, fans are always going to see things differently. I didn't know what the effect of the two new balls was either. It's something I'd heard so much about. And when you went into it, you did realize that it didn't have the kind of effect that people thought it did. But the real villain in this is not like some conspiracy to defraud Asian cricket. The real villain in this is that cricket was so lazy. And this includes all the Asian boards. The BCCI could fund research into fixing the white ball without actually noticing that they have done it. All right, if they go to the Mumbai offices in Wankhede and look behind the sofa, they'll have enough money to fix the white ball if they wanted to do so. Right,
That's right.
No one in cricket wants to spend any money. No one in cricket wants to do the work, and us as fans are left to guess at what effects these things have. Right, and as I said in the piece, there's no way the ICC did as thorough a research into the two new balls and the one new ball system that we had beforehand as I've just done. So they completely could have stuffed up cricket and without even telling that. And I know that for a fact because when Kookaburra changed the ball in 2021 and I wrote about it, the ICC didn't know that whatever it was, 10% of the runs had disappeared overnight in one day cricket, right? They just didn't know. And the point is that the people who are running the game are not doing this correctly. And it's not, unfortunately with cricket, I'd love to say that there's a lot of conspiracy. Generally, they're not even, what's the best way of putting it? They're not even good enough at being in a conspiracy. They're just dunces, right? Lazy, cheap, dunces. And so because of that, they make huge errors all the time.
That's right. Okay, so like South Africa has recently played really good ODI cricket against Australia. So what are their prospects in the World Cup? How do you rate South African squad in the World Cup this year?
Look, I think they've got, of the Western teams, they probably have the best bowling attack for Asia. So, you know, New Zealand and England really not suited very well to the Asian conditions. Australia a little bit more so, but maybe not quite at the level that South Africa is. And Australia don't have a strong fifth bowler in a lot of their matches, so that does weaken them a little bit. I think the South African top six has been superhuman for 4 years. My question is, can they be superhuman in four more games that really matter? So let's say we know they'll probably beat some of the weaker teams. So they should be able to win, I don't know, four games in this World Cup without any problems, right? And it's South Africa and it's a World Cup, so who knows? They might not do that, but they should be able to win four games without too many problems. It's really how they go in the other four games. Where they are going to be going up against the best teams who are as strong as them. Is that the time when one of those bowling attacks, you know, when, if they go up against Shaheen and Shaheen takes, you know, three wickets in the first four overs, that incredible batting lineup has been holding up. Does it hold up against that kind of kind of loss? You know, that we know they haven't lost a lot of wickets between overs 35 and 50, right? And so usually they lose 2, 3, 4 wickets, and then they just cruise to the end while scoring really quickly. Can they do that against Mitchell Stark, right? Who's been the best World Cup bowler 2 tournaments in a row, right? We don't know if he's going to be that again, but maybe he is, right? And it's those kinds of things that I think in South Africa's case is, I want to say it's tricky, but we don't know. We know they are going into every game with one less batter than almost every other major side. You know, Marco Janssen's batting has held up a little bit. It's a big ask for him to suddenly be, you know, a strong number 7 for them in this tournament. And then after that, it's just bowlers, right? That generally has what has got them in trouble early. And the weird thing is, if you look at the history of them in World Cups, they've kind of lost in both different ways. They've lost by having too many all-rounders who probably aren't strong enough as batters. And they've also lost in having too many batters who aren't strong enough as all-rounders. Sorry, too many bowlers who aren't strong enough with batting. So the pattern in the history of South African cricket is a bit wishy-washy in that way. But that is how they can lose, right? It's only going to take one Rashid Khan spell from Afghanistan or, you know, a couple of the Sri Lankan spinners to go through them or Siraj to take a bunch of wickets up top or Shaheen to take a bunch of wickets on top or Mark Wood or Mitchell Stark to be able to go through them. Does their method hold up? And it's been brilliant since the last World Cup, but does their method hold up in the, most importantly, the key games in the round robin, but more crucially, can it hold up for two games in the World Cup finals? And they don't have a choice because they don't have an all-rounder. So they have to play this way and they have to hope it works. And it has been working for a long period of time. But every time South Africa seems to come into a tournament with a really obvious weakness, at some stage in the tournament, that usually comes back and bites them. And that could just be dumb luck or, you know, it could be something else.
All right. Yes. Okay, Zarin, before we move on to our last segment, I want to ask two questions. One is regarding Chamar Yattapattu. She has been in form. She has been putting a great show against the likes of New Zealand and England. But she wasn't selected for the BBL. So it's your outputs on that. And secondly, we saw how Netherlands qualified against all odds. They were excellent in the tournament. So do you think that they deserve to get more games officially after that, how they qualified for the World Cup? I mean, we saw that Ireland got a series, even West Indies got a series. I mean, not to disrespect them, well, West Indies have been a quality side for ages. But don't you think that Netherlands should have gotten some series, some gotten official games to get some practice? They have been practicing in India. Some of the players have been county as well. But don't you think as a unit, as a one unit, there should be some series for them?
Yeah, so Yattapattu, the reason she's not in the Big Bash, from what I've been told from Big Bash teams, is because she's never particularly done well in the Big Bash. So she obviously has played before. I'd say she's in better form now than she's been at other times, so maybe this is the time to pick her. But I do think when you look at it, she's been slightly overlooked by some of the teams.
Yes.
Whether that will happen, if she keeps playing the way she is, she's just going to get picked, right? Like, she will come back. But there's no doubt that she's been overlooked in a way that perhaps some players from other teams have not been. But if she, I just can't see if she keeps playing at this level, that's going to continue. So the Netherlands, I would say the problem here, Kissa, is really, really simple. And it comes back to what we were talking about before, which is that Netherlands were the last team to qualify for the World Cup. And most of these other series were probably already planned before the Netherlands had qualified. Now, if this was a proper sport, perhaps what the ICC would have done is said, whoever qualifies last, they won't have time to probably organize mini bilateral series. So we're just going to organize bilateral series against whoever. And we won't even pay for that in this case to be able to have happen, so that they play three games against one team and four games against another team coming into the World Cup. The Netherlands had Netherlands are qualified for this World Cup.
Yes.
Largely because of how much cricket they played. Because they were part of the, you know, World Series League, ODI World Series League, whatever it was called. I've already forgotten that it existed. But because they had that, they played the most games in one-day cricket that they never played. They weren't particularly thought of as a massively strong ODI team coming into that tournament. They played against, you know, West Indies and Pakistan and England. Who's the other team they played at home? I think they played four teams in one summer at home, right? And they just improved. And they worked out who was good and who was a club cricketer. And they worked out who could work in different roles. And they just got a lot better. The problem is that they're not a very strong side. I would say that from a World Cup perspective, having Zimbabwe in the World Cup would have been better. Because World Cup is being played in Asia, and I think Zimbabwe is a better team in Asia, has better spinners and plays spinners better than what Netherlands do. So they've qualified for a tournament in Southern Africa, which is going to be played in Asia, right? You know, if we had an alarm bell here, we'd be ringing it. And we've seen this again and again. You know, we've seen teams qualify for, like, World Cups in Australia by playing well in the UAE. What, that doesn't help. That's going to help you in Australia, right? And so you have a team that I don't think it has a lot of spin options. I'm not sure any of them are any good. They haven't played spin very well as a batting unit either. And they're going to have to come to Asia without having played a lot of cricket against other good quality World Cup teams in those conditions. Yeah. So
I guess only Scott Edwards has good, better stats against spin, if I'm not wrong. Scott Edwards, the wicketkeeper and the captain of Netherlands.
Yeah, I mean,
he is one of those players who can play spin. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, they're not terrible. But if you look at their record over the last 3 years, when their better players have played, they haven't played it particularly well. But most importantly, between overs 10 and 40, they averaged 72 with the ball against the other World Cup teams, right? And their best spinner was Peter Saylor, who's not here. You know, he had to retire.
Yeah.
So instantly, you're looking at this team and you are saying that they're going to struggle. What's the one thing we could do to help them? Make sure that they at least play some games coming in. And that is how proper tournaments should go. And because cricket is bilateral, right? And because they qualified so late, the only way to do that correctly would have been the organizers of the tournament to ensure. And let's say they couldn't play one of the World Cup teams because all the World Cup teams had already booked other spots. They could have played Ireland, Scotland, Zimbabwe, West Indies, Namibia, right? They could have played other teams and you could have hosted them in UAE or Oman or wherever you want. Nepal could have hosted them if they wanted to, right? Everyone could have got paid off that and the Netherlands could have got better. There are ways of making this sport better, right? Goes back to the conversation we had about the Pakistan women's team. And the two balls. Everything comes back to the same thing, which is that no one is actually in charge of cricket. And so if I was to have this conversation, it would be with an ICC employee whose eyes would glaze over, not because they would even disagree with what I'm saying, but their first thought would be, well, how do we pay for that? And how do we get it past the other boards, right? And their second thought would be, this is a lot of work for us. Do we even have someone whose job it is to do this stuff? And the answers to that are probably all, no, it's too hard, so we won't do it. That's not good enough. This is the second biggest sport in the world. And the Netherlands, I think there's a very big chance the Netherlands don't win a game. Their seam bowling is incredible. And so I wouldn't put it past them to get, you know, to run through a team at one stage. So they might win a game. But there's a very big chance they won't win a game. And I don't mind if a team comes to a World Cup and doesn't win a game because it didn't work for them or they got injuries or, you know, just it was a tournament from hell. But it shouldn't be the case that you are not winning a game in large part because you haven't prepared as well as anyone else just because of the way the tournament was set up in the first place. And I think that is an issue for the sport.
Okay, Jared. So before we segue to our outro, just a quick prediction from you, like who will win this World Cup and who is going to be the man of the tournament this time?
Oh, man of the tournament. That's a fascinating question. So Mitchell Starc was the best player in the last World Cup and wasn't man of the tournament.
Yes.
They gave it to Ben Stokes, who was obviously fantastic in the final, but I'm not sure he was the best player in that tournament. So it'll go to someone from a winning team is the best way of putting that. So if you are putting your money on teams at the moment, I still think India, Australia and England are the favourites. I think, I don't know where Pakistan are around 8-1, I want to say, in the odds. And then New Zealand and South Africa, I think, are a little bit further out. So you would say it would come from one of the main players on one of the main teams. It's a bit of a random one. But I wonder if Bumrah or Siraj, if India win, might not be the players who have the biggest chance. I think if England win, Mark Wood might be the player who has the biggest impact. And then if Australia win, it should be Mitchell Starc. The problem with everything I've just said is that I've picked a bunch of bowlers, and chances are that, you know, a bowler won't win a player of the tournament. But I think those are the players from that perspective that make the most sense.
And
there's so many batters. I'm not sure who I would even go for in that kind of situation. Bairstow is someone who's really interesting, though.
Okay, so who is going to win then the World Cup this time?
I don't think England will win. So I think it's out of India and Australia. Unless South Africa do something incredibly special. I think they're the only team that can upset those two teams. And I haven't done it. The Travis Head thing makes me a little bit interesting. It should be India. I think India have been the best team for a while. They've been experimenting. They should have been doing this. So it should be India. But I think Australia have done a lot of things right in the last couple of years. The only thing they haven't done is really make their players play enough. But as we see with the main teams, that's kind of pretty standard now not to do that. So I think India should win the tournament, but I don't say that with any masses of confidence.
Okay, so that was a really good conversation with you, Jared, today. Thank you very much for gracing us with your presence. And viewers, you can go and check out Jared's channel on YouTube. His podcast is pretty much interesting. I mean, you have seen the insights that Jared presents on channel. So like, share and subscribe, and we will see you guys in the next one.